By the Advertising Standards Authority. The billboards, which said "Go home or face arrest," triggered 60 complaints. Some believe the language is racist. Rachel Robinson from the human rights group Liberty thinks it was a cheap stunt by the government that's backfired.
Nobody thinks it's actually going to lead to effective immigration control, but what it has done is caused deep offence in our communities amongst people who perhaps remember the last time we had a Go Home campaign in this country, and that of course was during the 1970s and it was orchestrated by the National Front.
A mafia boss who's been on the run for nearly 20 years has been told his secret life in England is over. 64-year-old Domenico Rancadore has been remanded in custody ahead of plans to extradite him to Italy. He was found living in West London. Michelle Clifford's at Westminster Magistrates Court and says the truth took everyone by surprise.
He's known to all of his neighbours as Mark Skinner. They all say he's a lovely man, a family man, a quiet man, and they have all expressed incredulity that he's now been exposed as what the Italians say, one of the most wanted fugitives in Europe.
Two British women attacked with acid on Zanzibar have arrived back in the UK for treatment. Volunteer teachers Katie G and Kirsty Trupp, both 18, were flown into RAF Northolt this afternoon. The IRA has admitted killing the only prison officer murdered in the Republic during the Troubles, Brian Stack. Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams has expressed his regret to the Stack family over the killing in 1983. Russia's been asked by the International Olympic Committee to clarify its law on gay propaganda. Gay rights campaigners have called for the Sochi Winter Games in 2014 to be boycotted over the new legislation, which President Putin signed in June. In sport, Australia's cricketers look to be just about on top of things on day one of the fourth Ashes test at Chesterleigh Street. A short time ago, England were 187 for 5 in their first innings. That's the latest. I'm Chloe Culpin.
You can listen again to any shows at bcfmradio.com and leave comments about your favourite programmes. BCFM 93.2, your interactive station, 24 hours a day.
It's Friday, 5 o'clock, and BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time. Helping us review this week's news is Labour councillor for St George East, Fabian Breckles. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, Filton's worst kept secret, known by some as MOD Procurement and others simply as DENS, which stands for Defence Equipment and Support. We take a closer look at the Tory Defence Secretary's Philip Hammond's eyebrow-raising proposal to privatise the work of Abbey Wood's 25,000 staff. And take a sip of coffee, or a snort of cocaine if you must, but don't forget the lives of those at the other end of the supply chain. We go to the heart of Colombia tonight to hear from a young British man who's just back from 4 years working on a farm at the heart of the jungle, watching everything. Plus, banned broadcasts from around the world. We go to Iran again. Banned Press TV, banned by Ofcom, apparently, inaccuracies that they've said. I mean, we know, don't we, the inaccuracies over the war in Iraq that our media said, but they haven't been banned. And also Google blocking access for the Iranians to their own YouTube account. You can still read it this end, but no new videos. Plus, Martin Summers takes us on his weekly tour of the world's hotspots, all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 13 Celsius and dry. This weekend, highs of 21, mostly sunny with some cloud. Next week, highs of 23 Celsius, mostly sunny again with a bit of cloud. Next weekend, 17th and 18th of August, highs of 20 Celsius again, fairly sunny. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. And thank goodness the land's got a bit of rain, didn't it, last week, beginning of last week and last weekend. So helping us review this week's news is Labour councillor for St George East, Fabian Breckles. Hi, Fabian. Welcome to Drive Time. First of all, Fabian, I can't help but ask you this. The Fabian Society is a Labour Party, or it's certainly a socialist thing, which was set up, and I've been doing a bit of swatting up after making the link between your name name and the socialists. Back in 1884, a London group of 70 wealthy socialists, a Fellowship of the New Life, which was based on the writings of scholar Thomas Davidson, who hoped to start some sort of monastic order. Now, tell us a little bit about the Fabian Society, because, you know, this is a socialist left-wing organisation, and your name's Fabian.
Basically, well, I'm a member of the Fabian Society, obviously.
Not obviously, so you decided to join, yeah?
I did decide
fairly early on in your life?
Sometime after I joined the Labour Party. I joined the Labour Party in 1992. Basically, they're a think tank these days, so they produce loads of pamphlets and ideas and sort of try and generate ideas and get things going. So that's basically what they are now. So
give us an idea of what is the Fabian. If what they're saying is true and it's a kind of monastic order, what's their vision for the future?
I think the monastic order idea is long gone. That's news to me. I never heard of that one before, and I suspect if there's any other Fabians living listening tonight, they're going to be thinking that's news to me as well. Basically, they're a think tank these days, and the idea I think was from the Roman general who sort of got achieved change by sort of a war of attrition. It's sort of about gradual change, rather than sort of the trots, send the tanks in, revolution, come the great revolution. This is about achieving change, you know, by sort of starting from where we are and gradually, you know, achieving change by gradual steps.
Some interesting characters, George Bernard Shaw, the playwright, also. Yep. One I would certainly raise some questions about, Annie Besant, who is one of the founders of the Theosophical Society. These were all part of the founding fathers and mothers, I suppose, of the Fabian Society. What about today? Okay, it's a think tank, but is the vision gone? I mean, are they just looking at one issue at a time? Because there isn't any kind of big socialist change anymore, isn't it? I'm saying is the Fabian Society are kind of redundant because everything's going in the opposite direction.
Well, I don't know that it is. I mean, there are ideas that are coming out, you know, things like the living wage that seems to be sort of very now, and there's sort of left and right wing reasons for plugging that. The left wing reason would be that everyone's entitled to dignity and a living wage, and a more right wing issue, which is potentially equally true, is if you give people a living wage to start with, they don't need in work benefits. And the bulk, despite the spin and the lies that the Tory government is spreading about benefits scroungers and all of that, most benefits are actually paid to people in work, or they're paid to pensioners.
Well, this is pie in the sky. Surely this is pie in the sky, Fabian. It's just not the money for it to be paying everybody these sorts of benefits you're talking about.
Well, that's where the living wage is a good idea, because it's about making the employer pay a decent wage. Because at the moment, what we're doing, if you've got in-work benefits, you've got people needing in-work benefits and in-work poverty, we're basically subsidising rubbish wages by unscrupulous employers, and you and me as the taxpayers are basically picking up the tab to sort of make up the difference. If they were given a living wage in the first place, they wouldn't need any sort of state handouts to help them, they'd have enough and they'd be able to just crack on with their lives.
Oh, hang on a minute, you're saying unscrupulous employers. Surely the real story here is many employers are having real trouble surviving and they have to pay low wages in order to actually carry on as a business. If they were to be forced to be paying whatever, a third more to their employees, they probably would be bankrupt by the end of the month.
Well, I think we need to look at the kind of bonuses that are being paid at the top of the tree. I mean, there's a growing gap between the sort of best paid, and you think about it, the wealthiest in this country have been hardly touched, hardly inconvenienced with this so-called age of austerity. The Tories gave a massive tax cut worth literally thousands to the wealthiest when they cut the 50p tax rate and went down to 45p. It sent completely the wrong message. They're doing things such as the bedroom tax, which is not about saving money. It's about pitching people against each other. It's about a so-called Skivers versus Strivers, you know, myth. The fact is, you know, that there simply are not the houses and the smaller, you know, flats, social flats, for people to move into. So if you've got a two-bedroom house and you want to move, you can't, because there isn't a one-bed place to go into. There was one of my colleagues on the Labour group told me about one of his constituents in Filwood. She'd agreed to move to a one-bedroom property from her home. It was available, it actually existed, but it needed 12 weeks, there was a 12 weeks renovation period because they had to do the flat up before she could move in. She got hit for the bedroom tax for those 12 weeks. How is that right? She agreed to move. The property was there that she could actually move into. Now, you think, if that's unfair, how about when people are being penalised by this and that isn't actually the small social housing for them to actually move into? They're stuck where they are because there's nowhere else for them to go and they're being penalised.
But you're dodging the question, Fabian, because most of the businesses are actually medium and small businesses. These are not the ones on the fat cat salaries, and they're struggling to survive. They cannot pay a living wage simply because the economy isn't allowing them to. They're not able to generate enough wealth within the business to pay people the sort of wages you want them to.
Well, we've got to start with actually growing the economy. I mean, this government is simply not interested in growing the economy. It has completely flatlined over the last 3 years. Government debt has rocketed, you know. And only recently reports were coming out that said that actually the Labour's government's handling of the economy in the run-up to the 2010 election wasn't that bad. And, you know, so there's been all these myths about, you know, oh, it's all our fault, by a government that's actually increasing borrowing, increasing debt, and destroying public services at the same time. I mean, you couldn't make it up. It's deliberate sabotage.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. This is particularly for Bristol quite a biggie because we have a big Somalian community here. Barclays Bank has decided that they don't want to do business with almost all of the banks, the small businesses in Somalia, for these credit transfers because, all sorts of reasons. They think that they may be being used for terrorism, money laundering, this kind of thing. And of course, that means that it's very, very difficult now for Somalis in Bristol to actually send money over there. I mean, what are your thoughts about this move? Because it seems to be sort of a line up almost with the policy, with the NATO policy on Somalia. So is Barclays Bank just part of that?
Well, I don't know. I mean, certainly a few years ago, Al Barakat was being used to pass money to Somalia, and the US government closed it down. This was not run by Barclays. This was another mechanism for people transferring money to family in Somalia, and they closed it down as a sort of anti-terror measure, supposedly. But of course, what they're really doing is condemning lots of families in Somalia to misery. And in actual fact, it's well established that the remittances from people in the West to countries around the world where they've come from are far more and far more effective than government-to-government aid in terms of helping these countries. People sending money to their relatives is probably the most useful thing that's going on. So sabotaging that is criminal.
Well, Mo Farah, who's a Somali-born British athlete, is saying that Barclays' cash transfer ban is threatening to plunge Somalia into chaos.
Well, exactly. I mean, think of the knock-on consequences of depriving families in Somalia of whatever small support they're able to get from their relatives abroad, and then say, do you think that's going to end the civil war in Somalia? And the answer is, no, it's not. It's like throwing meths on a bonfire, isn't it?
The Treasury, according to the Telegraph, is to look at the decision by major high street banks, including Barclays, to withdraw support from companies which transfer money to developing countries as a whole. We're not just talking about Somalia here. No. So this is a massive change, potentially.
Yes, it is, and I think all economic studies have shown that these transfers by people who are working you've got people working all over the world away from their home countries, and if they can't transfer money back to their relatives back at home, that's a real blow to development of the whole world economy. And it's one of the most important ways in which wealthier countries genuinely benefit poorer countries by their nationals working inside wealthier sections of the world economy and then passing money for love to people that they trust to spend on things that they want to spend on. A much better spend, for example, than giving lots of money to Saudi Arabia as export credits to buy weaponry.
Couldn't agree more.
Mo Farah, who was born in Somalia, is concerned because Dahab Shil, which is the country's biggest money transfer company, is one of the money remitters, which Barclays will not deal with anymore. Cutting this lifeline, he says, would be a disaster for millions. The small sums sent home by British Somalis each week enable family members to buy food, medicines and other essentials. He's been sending himself money back to Somalia for a number of years. Everyone following the issue understands that Barclays has a bank to run, but this decision could mean life or death to millions of Somalis, Fabian.
I couldn't agree more. It does sound appalling. And we have, of course, recently just elected our first ever Somali councillor in Hibak Jama, who's the councillor for Lawrence Hill. And I know she's onto it because I was at a event earlier in the week where she and Kerry McCarthy, our MP, were sort of discussing it. So it is on the political radar.
But I mean, this is actually up to Barclays. They're a private business. Surely they can do what they want. I mean, the Treasury's looking at it, but there's not a lot they can do.
Well, can I point out that the Barclays, there's a Bank of England report that came out recently, I think it was Andy Haldane, pointed out that Barclays' profits are at least 50% a result of the fact that they've got an implicit guarantee from the British government of their activities. So in other words, I think they made 14 billion last year, 7 billion of that is directly attributable to the British government's implicit guarantee of Barclays' activities. Now that implies that Barclays should show some social responsibility, or maybe we should just nationalise them and have done with it.
Is that feasible, Fabian?
Already got nationalised banks following the bank crisis, although this government, of course, wants to flog them off again, and probably at sub-market value rates to their chums. I do think, you know, we do need to properly regulate the banks, and that I think includes obliging them to social responsibility, not just here, but not just abroad, but here as well.
Well, talking about banks, we've got a new boy, haven't we, down at the Old Lady of Threadneedle Street. His name is King Carnage, or King Mark Carney. Yeah. He's taken over from King Mervyn. I actually think of these banks, and Martin, maybe you can come in here, whether they really are like feudal overlords, because we've heard this talked about several times now by commentators around the world, that actually the banks, particularly places like the European Central Bank, the IMF, the World Bank, really are like going back to the old feudal system.
Well, in actual fact, the Bank of England, the International Monetary Fund, and the European Central Bank are, in theory, all public sector institutions, but they are actually subject to what I call, or what is called in textbooks, regulatory capture. That is to say, Mark Carney didn't just work at the Bank of International Settlements and the IMF, he also worked for Goldman Sachs. So you have a revolving door between the private bankers and the so-called public sector. But of course, interestingly enough, the US Federal Reserve is not a public sector institution, it is in fact a private consortium.
Well, his old employers were both the Bank for International Settlements and the Bank of Canada. But
Goldman Sachs, far more important.
Well, but I'm looking at this, the central bankers, to what extent are they actually serving the interests of the public, and to what extent are they serving the interests of these casino bankers and gamblers like Goldman Sachs?
In theory, the public sector banking sector, you know, the World Bank, the IMF, the ECB, Bank of England was nationalised in Britain in 1946. They are supposed to be disciplining and controlling the private banking sector, but in actual fact, they just end up being a condom used by the private banking sector.
Well, before we hear, this is actually King Carnage's first proper talk, because he talked last week before, didn't he, about having Jane Austen on the notes, which was a sort of nice introduction to glide him in a nice PR style to being the King of Britain. Anyway, this is his first proper talk now this week, and a whole new plan for setting interest rates. But if you're driving, please, you may want to just turn the radio off for a minute in case you fall asleep and crash.
The MPC intends, at a minimum, to maintain the current exceptionally accommodative stance of monetary policy until economic slack has been substantially reduced, provided that this does not put at risk either price stability or financial stability. In practice, this means that the MPC intends not to raise bank rate above its current level of 0.5% at least until the labor force survey headline measure of unemployment has fallen to a threshold of 7%. While the unemployment rate remains above 7%, the MPC stands ready to undertake further asset purchases if further stimulus is warranted. But until the unemployment threshold is reached, the MPC intends not to reduce the stock of asset purchases from the current £375 billion. The Bank of England's unwavering commitment to price stability and financial stability.
Well, I'm going to fade him down there because we do want to have a few listeners left in 10 minutes' time still. Now, it sounds incredibly boring, just like King Mervyn when he gave his talks, Martin. It's almost mesmerising. Can you just decode that and put it into English?
Well, the first thing people need to realise is this is how central bankers talk. If he came out and said, actually, folks, it's time to panic.
Surely he can explain things better. I mean, he's using a fantastic amount of jargon.
The problem is that the markets are hanging on his every word, and it was the same with Mervyn King or with Ben Bernanke in the US. So if they say one word out of turn can move the markets and cost billions one way or the other, which is why they go for that soporific style. So people have just got to get used to that. That's what central bankers deliberately sound like. If they sounded excitable, then everybody would start freaking out. So that's not what their job is. Their job is to sound boring so that everybody goes to sleep and thinks actually there's nothing to worry about. Because their job, even if the whole economy was collapsing, their job would be to go out front and say, calm down everybody, we've got this under control. He's not supposed to come out there and say we've lost control of it.
But he's made a special new promise apparently over interest rates. Explain that.
What he's effectively saying, what's imported here is the same policy that's been pursued in the US and Canada when he was running the stiff in Canada, which is we're going to keep quantitative easing in place indefinitely until the economy picks up.
And he's also saying interest rates are going to be kept around about 0.5%.
Yeah, well, in actual fact, with the current level of inflation, that means negative interest rates. So in other words, for the last several years, you could have borrowed money for less than nothing. But even so, we're in a liquidity trap, to use the technical term, it's a Keynesian economic term. Even when you can borrow money for less than it costs, it's free to borrow money, businesses aren't borrowing it because they can't see any customers out there that's worth investing for. And ultimately, you can only break a liquidity trap by something like the New Deal, which was carried through in the US in the 30s, where the government started building roads, building hospitals, building schools.
But where do they get the money from to do that?
In actual fact, the government can borrow money, as you just pointed out, at 0.5%. In actual fact, you can also reform the money supply. The Positive Money website have been pushing this for some time now. So in actual fact, there's no reason why you should borrow money from private banks for the government to do stuff. The government can print its own money, as for example the Union did throughout the Civil War in the United States. And they didn't borrow the money from Wall Street, they printed their own money, spent the money to buy munitions and whatever they needed to fight the war. And then and what we've effectively done is we've subcontracted the money creation system to the private banks. Now that in fact is wrong. What we should do is take it back from them and cut them down to size, and that's one very good way of doing it.
Fabian, what are your thoughts about this? Because he's also not only saying that interest rates will stay very low, 0.5%, and he'll keep quantitative easing, he's going to wait until the rate of unemployment falls below 7% before he has a change of policy. So the idea is he's trying to say, well, until the economy really picks up, I'm just going to keep things as they are.
On one hand, you can think, well, fair enough, but to be honest with you, you need something, you need a real sort of regeneration program to actually get things going. I mean, most economic, we probably need a big house building scheme. We've got a crisis in housing. We've got, major problems with people need, 16,000, I think, at least, wait in the queue for a social house or a council house in Bristol. That's just in Bristol. And you never get out of this kind of mess without something like a big major house building program, which would kill loads of birds with one stone. You get people who need housing housed, you'd create jobs, and you'd create a bit of growth.
But there's no prospect, Martin, of this on the cards right now, is there? And also, of course, if Mark Carney does keep things exactly as they are, this is kind of lines up with Osborne and his policy. What we're seeing at the moment is virtually no growth at all. So that means, it's unlikely that they will get to the unemployment rate below 7%.
Well, he's saying at the earliest that will be in 2016, and that's being hopeful. So in other words, the unemployment rate officially, the Labour Force survey is about something like 7.8% at the moment. So even to bring it down, what we're talking about is 750,000 extra jobs. And even if things go well according to his plan, that won't happen until 2016. And then of course he's not really taking account of the fact that when Ben Bernanke the other week talked about tapering quantitative easing in the US, there was immediately a warning heart attack on the stock market. In other words, even with all of this money printing that's been going on for 5 years now, we still haven't managed to get any serious growth going in any of the economies. And the British economy, for example, is one of the only economies in this industrialised world that is still smaller than it was before the crisis began. So any upturn that we've seen in the last 3 months has to be seen in the context of the fact that the economy is still smaller than it was 5 years ago.
But remember what was said with the last Tory government about, unemployment is a price worth paying, because if you've got unemployment, you keep wages down, which means there's more money for their fat cat chums.
Yes.
I think part of this is deliberate. Part of it is incompetence, but part of it is deliberate.
Also, one thing one could say is rather positive that Mark Carney's done is Montague Norman, a Nazi sympathiser. This was in the Telegraph. Montague Norman was Britain's first modern central banker and governor for a remarkable 24 years until 1944, right the way up to and through the Second World War. But Mark Carney's decided to take his portrait down in the Bank of England, Martin. So he's really, I suppose, saying, you know, actually history does matter, and we don't really want this guy's portrait hanging around because he was helping fund Hitler and actually doing deals with him throughout the war.
Well, yes, and the Bank of International Settlements was very much a centre for that sort of activity, and Mark Carney himself used to be on that BIS board.
Well, that's interesting, isn't it? Because it's like he's saying, well, I want to separate myself from this kind of contamination of working for a bank which helped fund Hitler, and I want to actually say that Montagu Norman was a dodgy character during the war, and I'm actually, I suppose, he's worried about being contaminated.
What Montagu Norman did, in fact, one of the things he did, is when Hitler invaded Czechoslovakia, the Czechoslovak government in exile came to him and said, can we have the money that we deposited in the Bank of International Settlements so that we can, you know, get our government in exile going? And he said, oh no, the German-backed government in Czechoslovakia is now the government, so they get to get this money. And people like Churchill and others in Britain were saying that's outrageous and ridiculous, but Montagu Norman said, no, we've got to keep the same rules for everybody, we can't let politics interfere with finance. And throughout the war, the Bank of International Settlements was in fact facilitating the Nazi government's financial activities, and so was Prescott Bush, incidentally, who was the grandfather of George W. Bush. And at that level, Montagu Norman and various others were saying, well, we can't let politics interfere with finance, even though there was a world war raid.
Well, these documents that the Telegraph has unearthed reinforce the impression that Montagu Norman was an inflexible apparatchik, also renewing questions about his suspected Nazi sympathies, as outlined in Liaquat Ahmed's Lords of Finance. Norman was close friends with Halmar Schacht, yeah, Hitler's Minister of Economics and Reichsbank's president. Also in January 1939, Norman went to Berlin to attend the christening of Schacht's grandson, named Norman in his honour. Ahmed writes that Norman admired Schacht, and during the early years of Nazi rule, even the achievements of Hitler. He's said to have told a Morgan partner that Hitler and Schacht are the bulwarks of civilization in Germany. Schacht later turned against Hitler and was sent to Dachau in 1944. For suspected involvement in the attempt on the Führer's life, but he played a vital role in restoring Germany's fortunes under the Third Reich. This whole business, Fabian, is a little bit iffy and dodgy, isn't it, to the bankers, it seems. Don't really care necessarily until things are in the thick of it about political principles. And this Bank for International Settlements that Carney is still working for, in fact he's on the board of it and he's on two of the major committees, that certainly was funding Hitler in the run-up to the Second World War, and providing him with foreign exchange during the war.
Yeah, and you just have to think about how many people died in the concentration camps, how many people died on the front, simply because these people were financing, you know, keeping the war going by keeping the Nazi regime financed. I mean, it's just appalling. So yeah, right to take the portrait down, but I mean, it just sort of shows a sort of a built-in immorality in some of these people involved in the banking system, and it's obviously nothing new, but I mean, it's just appalling that you know, of course you did let politics get involved with finance, because you have to try and do what's right, and sometimes human beings being human beings, you get it wrong, but you have to try and do what's right, you have to try and be fair and humane.
On to a local story now from all this international stuff and macroeconomics. The council security staff in Bristol could be issued with handcuffs. This is a story in the Bristol Post by Louis Emmanuel. Security step-up is being considered by Robert Orrett, the authority's service director of strategic property. The walk-in customer service points around Bristol are currently protected by security staff who have a limited means of restraining people if trouble breaks out. When a serious problem occurs, security staff can only attempt to restrain people until the police arrive on the scene. Fears were raised that trouble could flare at any one of the five customer service walk-in centres where people seek help with issues over everything from council tax to the spare room subsidy, better known as the bedroom tax. Fabian.
Yeah, I mean, this is really quite worrying. This is about security from violence caused by poverty rather than caused by antisocial behaviour. I mean, I must admit, I had quite a bad experience in Amelia Court 20 plus odd years ago, when I was out of secure employment. I was sort of doing a bit of temping here and there, and I had a whopping great poll tax debt of over £400. Which doesn't sound, you know, which when you've got no secure income is a bit of a problem. And I found, you know, then they were very inflexible, didn't want to help me, and I was basically ended up getting rid of the debt by getting a very long hours temp contract for a couple of weeks, and I just sort of worked my slogged my guts out, got the money, just gave it to them, and just got rid of the debt that way. But I mean,
so what was your actual experience? What happened?
Well, I mean, there was one occasion where I went in and offered to start making some payments on based on what I could afford. And it was just a question, well, no, we're not interested, we'll just have to take you to court. Which, of course, would have meant I'd have got court costs plus everything else on top of the debt, rather than actually helping me find a way, or trying to enable me to find a way to actually start clearing the debt and start actually dealing with it. It was just a question, no, we'll just sort of add to it because we're bureaucrats. And since my election, I've actually had to help constituents who've had, you know, problems with an inflexible approach for our council tax people as well. So it's almost, you know, like what's changed. And I think there does need to be a big softening of attitudes. I appreciate that you know the government is deliberately slashing our funding as an authority there, you know, so things are difficult for the council. We can't say yes to everybody, but we have got to try and be humane. We have got to actually see the human being rather than just thinking, no, to heck with you, we just want your money and you can take a running jump if you can't pay. And if you start, you know, if you start being harsh and inflexible, people who have no means of paying, they are going to get distressed. And to simply say, oh, well, fine, we'll just cuff them, it's sort of like sticking a plaster on a gaping wound. It's not addressing the real problem, which is poverty.
Martin, Robert Orrit is deciding that the council staff might have to handcuff people.
Well, I mean, I think I agree with Fabian that you wouldn't necessarily have to think about these kind of measures if there was a more realistic policy in place. And of course, when you're chasing people with things like £400, you end up actually spending more money with the security. I mean, how much do handcuffs cost? I bet you good handcuffs cost quite, you know, how many pairs of handcuffs are you going to get for £400? So when you're chasing people for small amounts of money, it often makes sense to be very reasonable about that, because you could waste a lot more money chasing it than you're going to get. And of course, the real problem is that the council tax is poll tax mark two. It's a per head tax, so you're chasing individuals, which is very difficult to collect. Whereas, of course, the old boring rating system used to actually tax the property, which can't move, can't go anywhere, and if people don't pay, you just impound the property. So people, for example, in the past who were in rented accommodation, whether private or public, really didn't pay rates. They paid rates as part of their rent. So they didn't, and if the landlord didn't pay the rate, that was the landlord's problem and not theirs. And it's a much more efficient system, which is why the rating system carried on from the reign of Queen Elizabeth I until Queen Margaret of Thatcher decided to get rid of it. And that was because it's the best way. I mean, what we really need to do is to move back to property taxes on property, because that stops property bubbles, and it's easy to collect. Whereas chasing people who are doing part-time work for £400 is just not an efficient way to raise taxes.
Well, one explanation of this might be that Robert Orrit used to work for BNP Paribas Real Estate, which is one of the biggest property-owning managing companies in the world. So again, he's one of these people who is sort of going from the private sector and then coming in to the public sector.
Well, I've had some dealings with the council tax department at Bristol City Council when I was working at Bristol Debt Advice Centre, and I have to say that in actual fact their attitude would be similar to what I was just suggesting. They realised that there was a pretty poor tax, and that most of the people they were chasing, the people who can pay, the people who can't pay are the people who've got no money and are on small incomes. Yeah. So it's like trying to get blood out of a stone with those people. And one of the problems they used to have is that people just wouldn't contact them because they couldn't pay. They wouldn't contact, and then they had like a picket line. They showed me, we have like a picket line outside the court, so when they come to court we stop them, and they're about to go into court, so we don't want you to go to court, we just want to speak to you about your debts. Well, that's what we really want to do.
Fabian, I mean, again, I'll come back to this question of people coming from the private sector into the public sector, maybe used to using private security to handcuff people who have broken into a building in the private sector isn't necessarily the same as dealing with someone who's come because they're desperately poor and need some help with their housing benefit. Now, that company that he used to work for has got a turnover of something like £500 million. This is another very big organisation that does property management. Is he the right person to be doing this job in Bristol for the council?
Well, I mean, obviously there's a interview process, there's a whole recruitment and selection process that the council has to go through, and there's laws about making sure that you do so sort of, you know, without breaching quality laws and stuff like that. And I don't personally see a problem between people moving from the private to the public sector or vice versa. That there's good ideas that, you know, to be had in both parts, you know, parts of the spectrum. So I see no problem with that.
And how long until
that's
council?
Not what I'm worried about this.
And how long until council security staff get tasers to fire at people if they kick
up
a fuss?
I know this is that's the issue. That's not, you know, whether someone who's in charge has come from the private or public sector or is an ex-cop or whatever doesn't actually matter. But, you know, as long as they're the fit and competent and the right person for the job and the best candidate when the interviews were held. So I'm not so bothered about that. I do think this is, you know, the wrong solution to the wrong problem, and I agree absolutely with Martin that we should be looking to go back to a rating system. It was good enough for Queen Elizabeth I, and it was good enough for everyone up until Thatcher. Then, you know, it's an obvious thing to go back to, and also it's much fairer because the rating system was about, you know, varied from property to property, so it was much more, had a much broader scope between the smallest properties and the largest properties, whereas at the moment you've got every, you know, you only go from band A to band H. It's deliberately, when the council tax was brought in, it was deliberately made to push the sort of the burden downwards.
Well, of course,
more modest
and make people
actually cap how much you have to pay for the biggest properties.
Make people pay who are actually the tenants who are least able to afford to pay, rather than the people that own the property. Anyway, on to our next story. UK population is the fastest growing in Europe, says The Independent and many other outlets this week. The UK's population grew more in the past year than any other in Europe, according to figures out today, up by 420,000 to 63.7 million. In the year to June the 30th, France's population was up 320,000 and the UK recorded more than 800,000 births in the past year. Biggest baby boom since 1972. There were only 558,000 deaths at this time. Well, it sounds good news, doesn't it, since the births are outstripping the deaths. Now, what are your thoughts, Fabian, about this? Because we've had a lot of this, of course, is due to migration, and I think it's something like a quarter now of all children born in Britain are born to women who actually were born outside the UK, have come in and are now having children here. So this is doing very, very well in keeping our up a massive demand for housing and pumping up the housing bubble. But what about the other effects it's having on the country?
Well, obviously the other side of that is to say that three quarters of the births are born from people who are already here anyway and not from migrants. So, you know, there's you know, which sort of makes it sort of feel a bit different. I mean, obviously, how you pay your pensions is you need a workforce, you know, so you need people to sort of grow, work, you know, get an education, work, pay their taxes, and that sort of keeps the wheels of the economy working. It also keeps the sort of tax income coming to pay old age pensions and stuff like that. So, you know, Japan has a problem because it's got an aging population. You know, the birth rate in countries like Japan is sort of dropping off, which means that they're actually getting a huge bubble of old people and no one coming in underneath to sort of work, you know, and pay the taxes and actually pay for all their pensions and their healthcare and everything else. So, you know, you do need, obviously, there's ultimately, this is an island. There's only so many people you can comfortably accommodate on an island, but we do need sort of, you know, people sort of grow up and work to pay our taxes and sort of, you know, people are born now, by the time I retire and I need my pension, they'll be the ones working and paying my
well, you hope they will. You hope they will have a job. Yeah. Anyway.
Well, you didn't.
Martin, can I just ask you on this? Around about 500,000 migrants, and of course, the effect of this is all of these people need jobs. What's happening is, I mean, over the last probably 15 years or so, all different sorts of governments, what's the effect of it has been actually depressing wages and depressing pay and conditions to the situation now where we're all doing this ridiculous business of zero-hour contracts for people having to sign contracts, and even though they might not get any work at all during the week. And this has had a really, really big effect on the power balance, the power relationship between employer and employee. This is only one aspect to this population survey, but what are your thoughts about whether the migration and immigration policy has been wise?
Well, the fact is that if you've got a robust system for enforcing things like living wage and you know, proper contracts and so on, it doesn't really matter, because it doesn't matter where people come from, they've got to be employed at a certain level. But it also angers me when you think about, for example, those Chinese people from Fujian province who got killed getting mussels in Morecambe Bay. How are those people stealing from you? Because they're not claiming any benefits. They're just...
You never knew they were there.
Can we actually just talk about the policy rather than in any way trying to... Nobody's trying to blame the individuals involved.
No.
This is a policy,
well,
yeah?
As we know, all over the world, population is rising. It is. And they've got to go somewhere. And if they're not... I mean, for example, all the Syrians who've fled from the war in Syria are now constituting up to a third of the population of Jordan. Now, why should Jordan, as a country, bear that burden 100% on its own?
But the mass migration has got nothing to do with asylum seekers. It's got to do with economic migration. And whether you think that's a good idea or not.
It's got to do with both. I mean, there's quite a lot of Poles over here, for example. I lived in Poland in the 1990s. And, of course, the economy over there was destroyed by Balcerowicz and the International Monetary Fund. So there's no work in little towns like Lubartov, where I lived in Poland. So those young people have got to get on their bikes and go. And they did. And in actual fact, if the IMF hadn't trashed the Polish economy, they'd have been much happier to stay home. And what's happening with globalisation and IMF structural adjustment all over the world is that that also provokes wars and conflict, like in Yugoslavia, and then people leave, and then they end up turning up on somebody's doorstep. And I would suggest that Tory governments who are pushing this structural adjustment in Latin America, in Africa, and all these other places, the consequence of that is those people are going to turn up on your doorstep and say, give us a job, mate.
Fabian, another aspect to all of this, of Absolutely. Course, is actually there is a very positive story here, and that is that people are living longer. I mean, I don't know why, but for some reason, a lot of commentators, when they talk about this, talk about it in a very doom-laden way. Oh, it's terrible. People are living longer. You know, we're going to have to help support them. Actually, the fact of the matter is, people, if they're ill, tend to be only ill for a certain same period. It just, you know, this is actually part of the success of Britain since the Second World War, is that we're actually helping people to live a long time.
Well, yes, but obviously it's all down to sort of quality of life. I mean, my late mother had Alzheimer's for the last 3-4 years of her life, and that was pretty horrible to watch. I wouldn't wish it on anybody, either to be the relative of someone with that condition or to actually have it. It was terrible. But I mean, so it all depends on quality of life. But I think what Martin was saying about migration, I mean, years ago I went to a talk by some trade unions about how migrants are deliberately being used, are actually being ripped off. They're being deliberately being used to as cheap labour. They're then being accommodated, housed in overcrowded, given a mattress in a, you know, four mattresses in a room in an overcrowded house somewhere, being charged rip-off rents for that accommodation, which is then, of course, taken out of their already illegally low wages. And so they're not getting a good deal out of it anyway. So actually, if you want to get rid of the idea of, you know, all these people coming in stealing our jobs, you've got to enforce them, you know, enforce living wages, enforce working conditions, proper contracts. We've got to ban zero-hour contracts. I mean, you know, it's one of the things that's got to be in the next Labour manifesto. We've got to ban them. You know, if you being taken on by an employer, the employer has got to guarantee you at least some work. It's got to be worth something. Even if they have to give you a sort of a part-time contract and then say if there's, you know, and then give you overtime and give you extra hours if they're available, at least you know you've got some money coming in and you can start planning ahead and working out how you're going to pay your bills, where you're going to get your food from.
Yeah, okay, you mentioned zero-hour contracts. Let's talk about that. This is Vince Cable here stepping into the dispute. 1 million workers could be employed on these controversial zero-hour contracts, four times more than the number estimated by official Whitehall statisticians. Oh, well, I suppose there might be some other Whitehall statistics that we might have to just throw up and put in the bin. According to a survey of businesses, the scale of the practice whereby employees have to be available for work but are not guaranteed any set number of hours has prompted fresh calls for a ban on the zero-hour contracts. Martin, the numbers are, first of all, we were told 250,000 people were on these contracts, then 300,000, and now 1 million.
Yes, and it's
probably, that's just within about a month or so.
Yes, and it's probably going up as we speak, because that's the direction of travel of the economy.
Almost everyone that works in McDonald's, almost entirely, it was something like 95% of McDonald's employees are on these contracts.
Well, coming round to pick up on something you said earlier about if companies were forced to pay living wage, they'd go out of business. And you know what, Tony? You're right. And in places like Norway, they've used the living wage over generations to bankrupt companies which cannot pay a living wage. They're not interested in having crummy businesses that cannot pay living wage. And in actual fact,
You say, well, at least they've got a job. You say, no, because a crummy business employing people on crummy wages and a crummy contract is actually sucking in resources that could be better deployed in a better business, better run.
So the only companies that can survive are ones who are big multinationals who are helped by the banks.
Not in Norway, because they've got a big public sector and all the rest of it. But for example, if you go to Norway, you'll see that a pint of beer will cost you £5. That's because the person serving at you is not earning £5 an hour. And of course, but your wages as a Norwegian, as a unionised worker, for example, in the oil industry, are more than enough to pay £5 for a pint of beer. And that's the way they've... It's a high-wage, high-productivity economy. That's what we should be doing. That's what we should have been doing years ago.
And also, the point is that, as you've just said, it's places like McDonald's that are using zero-hour contracts. They're not exactly a small, little backstreet start-up business struggling to rub two pennies together. That is a multinational, global multinational with plenty of money. I'm wondering whether we should actually consider boycotting these companies, these bigger companies that are using zero-hour contracts, and still they start giving their staff proper contracts with proper hours and a guaranteed income for a guaranteed set hours of work.
There's been a big strike wave in the major cities in the US in fast food in the fast food industry in the last month.
Yeah, all power to them.
Now on to an international story. I hope you don't mind, Fabian. The Fukushima drainage has 20,000 tons of water with radioactive substance in. This is the TEPCO, the Tokyo Electric Power Company, saying on Tuesday this week the drainage system of the crippled Fukushima reactor nuclear power plant contains more than 20,000 tons of water with high levels of radiation. It said it's detected 2.3 billion becquerels of cesium per litre in water around in the underground passages at Fukushima, which is leaking into the groundwater through cracks in drainage tunnels. Now, this is just horrific. This is leaking, finding its way into the sea around there, no doubt. And they're worried. They're even talking, Martin, about potentially trying to freeze this water so it can't leak through anymore by having some sort of massive cryogenic system on top of it. Now, we're in the situation here where we're looking at new nuclear power in the Bristol Channel, Hinkley, to be precise, which seems to be one of the one of the first of the new generation possibly to be built. So maybe Fabian, how this might inform our decision as to whether we build another Hinkley 3, another nuclear power station down the road.
I think it all depends on the technology of the nuclear power station. Obviously, if somebody said, it's like when I was first in the Czech Republic, I was on a touring holiday in the Czech Republic in 1994, and I was told that over some hill somewhere was a power station that was exactly the same design as the Chernobyl one that had had that terrible meltdown years before. The question is the design of the power stations and how robust they are. Obviously, the ones that are being proposed in Britain aren't the same design as the TEPCO plant in Fukushima. And obviously I don't think we've got the same risk of tsunami or earthquake in Britain. So it's a question of, if it's modern technology, think about the environmental risks and think about how you make sure that the whatever nuclear power station you do build is safe and will resist those resist those risks, environmental risks. I mean, the problem is that we have got to cut down on carbon emissions. We've got to reduce our carbon emissions. We've got to move to more electricity instead of fossil fuels. We're talking with the BR, with the Metro bus. They're looking at maybe using electric buses that are charged up and then sort of charge up at the bus stops and things like that.
So it might have to wait. Might have to wait a long time for a bus if it has to charge up when it.
Well, it charges up overnight. It sort of charges up for 12-second bursts. When we were going around with George Ferguson around St George yesterday, it came up in the conversation. It's something that gets mini bursts of electricity when it stops at bus stops, but it gets charged up overnight, so it gets a full charge overnight before it goes into service. But the point is that we are going to have to, renewables aren't filling the gap enough as we wind down fossil fuels.
But I mean, surely
so
the
we're going to have to use
Fabian,
some nuclear. So
the problem
we're
with
have
diesel
to make sure it is safe nuclear
and petrol is not the buses; it's the cars. The cars, the millions and millions of cars that are using this, not the buses. I mean, if more people
not
could use, if more people
buses
could,
can use,
if all those people in
the
cars, the
emissions of a new car. I've got my car's outside. We both came here by car. My car's got a Euro 5 engine, so it's a modern, clean engine.
If you can get 80 people who would be using a car into a bus, surely that's you're not having anywhere near as many emissions. I mean, that's basic.
Well, I'm pro public transport. I really want to see sort of public transport in this city take off, and I really don't think that we've used the resources that we've got to best effect. We've got a suburban railway line that, in Newcastle, for example, was turned into a metro, the backbone for a metro system. In 1980, it's now 2013. We're talking about only now about the Henbury Loop and actually expanding the railway systems.
We have actually
people real choice and get them out of their cars.
Come a long way from the discussion about Fukushima and Hinkley. But Martin, what are your thoughts about this? One of the things they're saying, TEPCO is saying that they've got to strengthen the barriers as well as increase the speed in which water is pumped out. The station's accumulated more than 360,000 tons of radioactive contaminated water. After they suffered their March 2011 meltdown. The responsible for decommissioning the REC plant, they estimated that contaminated groundwater could reach the surface within 3 weeks. This is the first time they've actually admitted. All times in the past they're saying, oh yes, we're containing it. Now they're saying it's leaking out into the sea and into the groundwater all around the plant.
Yeah, it's an ongoing tragedy which the world I bet the Japanese are paying more attention to it than we are. But it's an ongoing tragedy. The point I'd make about nuclear power is this. I wrote a paper about nuclear power, the economics of nuclear power, in the 1990s for the New Economics Foundation when I was employed there. And if you remember, the Thatcher government in the 80s they wanted to privatise the nuclear industry like all the other industries. They were very keen to do it, and the City of London were keen to get their claws in because they thought, great, there'll be some profits in there for us. But when they actually looked at it objectively, they found that you cannot have nuclear power without state subsidy, and the reason is quite simple, because the waste lasts for thousands of years. Now, unless the government takes that waste away, and so that you don't have to consider the waste, if the private sector has to factor in looking after that waste for thousands of years, and for example something like Fukushima happens, that they've got to be insured against that and all the rest of it, it's just not viable. Now, I don't believe that you should not run things because they don't make a profit. I'm a socialist. I believe that some things like health services and so on shouldn't be run at a profit, but I can't see much of a case for running nuclear power at a loss when there are other alternatives. And the other point I would make is this. People may have remembered about the Stuxnet virus. The Stuxnet virus has been admitted now that the Israelis and the Americans wrote the Stuxnet virus and introduced it into the Bashashir nuclear plant in Iran, causing their computers to crash and the plant to malfunction.
Well, they actually lost control of the reactor.
They lost control of it. And I was reading, I think it was in the New York Times or the Washington Post, they reported this to President Obama as the good news, Mr. President, is the virus has actually smashed up the Iranian nuclear program. Fantastic. The bad news is that one of their employees took the thing home on a memory stick, put it into his own computer, and now the Stuxnet virus is roaming around looking for any nuclear power station to trash. So how irresponsible is that, that US and Israeli taxpayers' money have been used to write a malware program for crashing nuclear power stations? They wanted it to crash the Iranian nuclear power station, but it's now out there potentially able to crash it. And there was even hints that some of the problems at Fukushima were caused by the Stuxnet virus.
Fascinating. Stephen Fry has been calling for the Sochi Olympics ban over gay rights, and Russia is insisting the rights are not violated. This is Stephen Fry's letter to both David Cameron and to the International Olympic Committee. Just a quote from the letter, he says, it's simply not enough to say that gay Olympians may or may not be safe in their village. The International Olympic Committee absolutely must take a firm stance on behalf of the shared community it's supposed to represent against the barbaric fascist fascist law that Putin has pushed through the Duma. Fabian, would you like to comment on this? Do you think we should boycott the Russian Winter Olympics?
I think what's happening in Russia with gay rights is absolutely appalling. You see it on the TV when you get, you know, the police beating up LGBT rights campaigners, and you know it's deplorable. Of course, there's loads of areas where human rights of minority groups are being violated. You think about, you know, the violence in Syria, or you know, the Christians there are being basically displaced and driven out because the Islamists are taking in and they're picking on the scapegoats. In Egypt, where you know, moderate Muslims and Copts have, you know, were demonstrating to get shot of Muslim because Morsi, because he was you know, because of his sort of, you know, agenda of sort of, you know, fascist Islam. When the army came in and replaced him, his Muslim Brotherhood supporters have been actually picking and targeting Christians in Egypt in reprisal attacks. So, you know, any attack on a minority group, however they are defined, is not acceptable. We have to coexist. We have to accept diversity. We have to accept that, you know, diversity is normal. It's good. It's part of the colour of life. And so what Putin is doing is deplorable. What, you know, all these sort of totalitarian mindset of you fit in or else mindset is just, you know, completely unacceptable.
Martin, they're also talking about boycotting Russian vodka too. There was one Russian official, Deputy Prime Minister Dmitry Kozak, who's in charge of planning the Olympic Games. He said in reply to Stephen Fry, there's no infringement of individuals' rights based on their sexual orientation, either at the Olympics or up to the Olympics, and there will not be after. This legislation does not provide for it. And he goes on to say that there's no prison sentences as part of this legislation, and it's only about promoting homosexuality to minors. The law states that Russian individuals can be fined up to 5,000 rubles, that's about £120, for distributing literature which could be read by minors in public. And this is what it's about.
Yeah, in other words, it's very similar to Margaret Thatcher's Clause 24, which was...
28.
Clause 28, sorry, I've forgotten the exact... So in other words... I disapprove of that as a legislation, but it's not actually. I mean, there are plenty of right wing conservatives in the US, for example, who would regard that as an absolutely legitimate kind of thing.
Interesting.
Yeah? So you know, there are quite a lot of right wing conservatives here probably would be quite happy that they don't like gay rights anyway. But the idea that gay people are not allowed to try and persuade youngsters of the value of gay relationships, I mean, I don't think that's right. But you can see that on the right wing of politics in Russia and as elsewhere, people do think this, and I think it's open to debate. To be honest, I don't think it's worth boycotting an Olympics about. But let's put another point to people. Qatar is going to be running the World Cup. Qatar is there are no democratic elections of any really serious kind in Qatar at all. Putin is in fact elected overwhelmingly, and Qatar makes all homosexual acts completely illegal with very severe penalties. Perhaps we should just cancel the World Cup in Qatar, and then of course all of the Western companies which are going to make money out of that will have to lose their money.
And the Formula One race in Bahrain.
Oh, yes, Formula One racing in Bahrain. Exactly. What are they doing, Formula One racing in Bahrain? In fact, let's just end all sports unless we've got a complete free society to have the sports in. So we'll have to have a revolution first, and then we can have our sports.
So, I mean, it is worth pointing out the Tamil activist group is condemning the British Foreign and Commonwealth Office because they want the foreign heads of government meeting to happen in Sri Lanka, which the Sri Lankan government is actually guilty of killing between 30 and 40,000 civilian Tamils.
Because Britain was involved in the Iraq war, which was clearly an illegal war, nobody should play any of our sports teams. It's an obvious matter of principle.
Martin, you seem to be implying that maybe this has got something to do with foreign policy with regard to Russia's support for Iran and Syria
Putin is an interesting phenomenon politically. I happen to believe that he and the FSB were behind the bombings in Moscow in September 1999, which led to his election, because they were blamed on the Chechens. But basically, he's a rather nasty character. But on the other hand, he has won elections overwhelmingly in Russia, and they're not entirely free and fair, but they're a lot better than elections in the US.
Okay, well, sorry you don't get a chance to come back, I'm afraid, Fabian, because it's time for the Murdoch News at 6 o'clock, and Murdoch comes first at this time of the day. Thanks to this week's guest, Labour Councillor for St George's, Fabian Breckles. After the news, take a sip of coffee or a snort of cocaine, but don't forget the lives of those in Colombia.
Award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, a campaign by the Home Office to target illegal immigrants is being investigated by the Advertising Standards Authority.